Welcome to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. A healthy U.S. military depends on the physical and psychological well-being of its servicemen and women. But according to a new study from the RAND Corporation, Pentagon healthcare providers are failing to provide service members diagnosed with depression or post-traumatic stress disorder with the appropriate follow-up care they need. We're talking about military mental health care. Joining me by phone is the lead author of the study, Kimberly Heppner. She is a senior behavioral scientist and a licensed clinical psychologist at the RAND Corporation. Her research focuses on approaches to assess and improve quality of care for mental health and substance use problems. We have a link to her report on our website at wosu.org/allsides. Welcome, Kimberly.
Thank you for having me, Gail.
Can you tell me initially what this study was started for, what they were looking for?
So the Department of Defense asked RAND to conduct an independent assessment of post-traumatic stress disorder care and depression care delivered by the military health system to service members. And this is perhaps one of the largest independent assessments of this care that's ever been conducted. We were able to include nearly 30,000 service members with PTSD or depression and look at the kinds of care that they receive and assess whether the care aligned with practice guidelines. Did they receive the kinds of care that were recommended for their conditions? And this assessment was driven by really trying to identify what are the areas of strength of the military health system and what are areas where the military health system can improve.
Mm-hmm. How did you conduct your study? You said it sounds like it was broad-ranging in the numbers.
It was very broad-ranging. So we brought together multiple data sources in order to conduct this evaluation. It was largely driven by care data. So we've got data on the types of visits that service members receive, how many visits, the types of prescriptions that they receive. We also conducted a sample of medical record review. So we actually looked at what the providers documented in the medical record, giving us very detailed information about the kinds of care that service members receive for their PTSD or depression. We also looked at symptom measures that service members completed to help us understand how service members improve over time. So we integrated several data sources.
Well, what were some of your key findings?
We actually found that the military health system did quite well in a variety of areas. So, for example, the military health system performs well in screening for suicide risk. So we found that 96% of service members with PTSD actually had a documented screening for suicide risk in their medical record. And this is a very important screening to conduct. It helps providers to identify who might be at risk for harming themselves. And that was conducted for the vast majority of service members. We also found that around 90% of service members with PTSD or depression were screened for alcohol or drug problems. And that's also a very important screening to identify service members who may need additional assistance with those kinds of problems. We also found that the military health system is a leader in providing follow-up care for service members when they're discharged from a psychiatric hospitalization. In fact, we found that they outperform civilian healthcare systems on this measure. This is a very important time. So when service members are released or discharged from the hospital, from a psychiatric hospitalization, we want to make sure that they get connected to outpatient care to help to ensure that that transition is a safe one for the service member. And the military health system really does well at conducting that follow-up.
Did that surprise you, or did anything surprise you?
Well, I was surprised to see the high rates of screening. The screenings are very essential to conduct. They help to identify which service members might need additional attention or different types of referrals. And the providers and the military health system really did very well at that. So we were quite surprised to see, particularly for alcohol and drug problems. We believe that this screening rate is higher than what we might find in civilian healthcare systems.
You call it the military health system. Is it open for all military branches?
Yes. So our study included all military branches, and the military health system as a whole provides medical care and mental health care for service members, their families, and some retirees. It's a different system than the VA. So this was a separate evaluation than the care that is delivered at VA. But the military health system serves, all of our active component service members, reserve and guard at times. So quite a large, important system for our country.
We're talking about military service members diagnosed with PTSD or depression and the quality of care they receive. My guest is Kimberly Heppner. She is a lead author and clinical psychologist at the RAND Corporation. If you have a question or comment, give us a call at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Kimberly, you found that the military health system had higher rates of follow-up after psychiatric hospitalizations compared to other healthcare systems. Any reason for that?
Well, we think that this could be due to specific policies that the military has put in place to help ensure that follow-up happens. They advise on not discharging a service member, for example, on a Friday afternoon to help to ensure that they can get them connected to that outpatient care as quickly as possible. So we believe that this was really a conscious effort by the military health system to set out policies, to guide providers, to guide the system to help to ensure that this follow-up occurs. So we view this as a particular strength for the military health system and really demonstrating that the military health system can be a leader in these aspects of mental health care. And so that's why even though we've identified particular areas where the military health system can improve, we have demonstrated or we believe that with targeted efforts to improve these other aspects of care, the military health system really can continue to do better and better for our service members with mental health conditions.
Your report also found that less than half of psychotherapy delivered to service members was evidence-based. First, what do you mean by evidence-based?
That's right. And actually, one of the bright spots that we found was most service members with PTSD or depression received at least some psychotherapy. So, for example, over 90% of service members with PTSD received at least some psychotherapy. So it's tremendous access to getting psychotherapy, which is one of the effective treatment options for PTSD and also depression. But when we looked at the types of psychotherapy that service members received, we found that less than half of service members with PTSD and depression received a type of psychotherapy that's been shown to be effective. So these are cognitive behavioral type therapies. Certain types of psychotherapy have been shown from the research evidence to be helpful for both PTSD and depression. And we were really looking to see if those therapies were documented in their medical record. So we've identified this as an area for the military health system to improve, to improve the rates of providing these types of evidence-based psychotherapy to service members.
And why do you think that was so, that they didn't offer that to everyone?
It can be quite challenging there are actually several different types of psychotherapy. It can be quite challenging to ensure that providers are trained in the latest and greatest or what we know to be a recommended type of psychotherapy. And so that can be a bit difficult to ensure that it happens, and it really involves training and monitoring of the types of care that are being provided and encouraging providers to deliver these recommended psychotherapies.
It's interesting that you say a lot of the military received some sort of help once they went to look for it. The question is, especially if they suffer from some form of PTSD, how many are actually seeking help?
And that was something, that's a very good question. So that was something our study was not able to address directly. So we were able to focus on those service members who came to the military health system and actually received a diagnosis of PTSD or depression. And so you're absolutely right. We're not able to include those service members who may not have sought care or may have sought care and perhaps their PTSD or depression was not identified, or even sought care for their PTSD or depression from another healthcare system, say from private employer insurance. And so we weren't able to assess that, and we certainly know that there are some service members with PTSD that we have missed and have not been included in our study. So it's a very important question.
So who do you recommend to help these folks get to the help they need, especially if there's some resistance?
Yes, it can be quite, there can be several barriers to getting to treatment. So we know that sometimes stigma or fear of impact on a service member's career may get in the way. Simply military duties and needing to step away to get care can be a barrier. Making sure that there are available appointments for a service member when they do come to the MHS to get their PTSD or depression treated, it can be very important, those regular appointments and appointment times that work for the service member. So there can be quite a lot of barriers or hurdles along the way to get care. And so we want to work to minimize those, and there are several efforts by the military health system to reduce stigma, to encourage service members to seek help. But the other piece of this is to ensure that when they arrive at the military health system, when they do seek help, that the care is of very high quality. And we do see that service members receive quite a lot of care, and we just want to make sure that the care that they receive, whether it's medication treatment or whether it's psychotherapy, that that care is high quality.
What I found interesting in your report was that the quality of care for PTSD and depression was different or varied by the service branches. Why the inconsistency there? Well, not the same for the Army, Navy, Air Force.
That's right. So we did find variability in the quality of care across service branches. And it's important to note that we didn't find that one service branch, say the Army, outperformed other service branches consistently. In fact, the Army led on some measures, the Air Force led on some measures. So quite a lot of variability. And so what we've recommended is to try to understand that variability and how the service branches, and it's important to remember that even though the military health system ties together the service branches in delivering care for our service members, each service branch delivers their own mental health care and their own medical care. And so there's something to be learned, we think, from how the service branches are delivering excellence on different aspects of care. So we've encouraged learning more about what might contribute to this variability and shared learning amongst the service branches of how care can be improved.
Mm-hmm. And what are your ideas on how the care can be improved? What areas should be tackled first?
So we believe that this transparent, independent assessment is really the first step. As the military health system showed leadership in asking for this evaluation to be done, to publicly sharing what are the strengths and what are the areas for improvement. And this is a model for other healthcare systems in that way. So we've encouraged the military health system to take this information and continue to work to improve the quality of mental health care. One of the foundations that can be strategies that can be used is improving or expanding the quality measurement that is done. So the military health system now monitors the quality of care that is being delivered, but it's predominantly medical care. They've increased the transparency, reporting out how they've done, and this can be found on their website, health.mil. And they report out on several aspects of care on how they're doing, including results by individual military treatment facilities and service branches. But there are only two measures that are included there that are specific to mental health. And these are those two measures that I mentioned that they do quite well on, which is a timely outpatient follow-up after a service member is discharged from a psychiatric hospitalization. So they're doing quite well on those two measures that they are reporting out. So we've really encouraged the military health system to expand their reporting of mental health-focused measures. And this transparent reporting really gives them the information that they need in order to target improvements and to monitor how those improvement efforts are going.
Kimberly Heppner, thank you for joining us.
Of course. Thank you for having me.
She's a lead author and clinical psychologist at the RAND Corporation. Wellness Wednesday will continue with facts and fallacies on being left-handed. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. This Sunday is International Left-Handers Day. It might seem silly to dedicate a day to Southpaw Pride, but the left-handed have been maligned throughout history in cultures around the world. The practice of retraining left-handers to use their right hands has been commonplace and may have detrimental effects. Joining us now by phone is historian of medicine and neuroscience Howard Kushner. His new book is called On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History. Welcome to the show, Howard.
Hi, Gail. Thank you for having me on.
Left-handers have their own day. Who knew?
Right. At first, it seems trivial, but when you look at the history of how left-handers have been treated, like other disabilities, the sense of pride has helped overcome feelings of inferiority that have been put on people who are left-handed over the ages.
Do you really consider being left-handed a disability?
No, I don't, but it is a difference. And the real question is, why is it that 10% of the human population since recorded time and before are left-handed? No other animal is, animals may be left or right-handed, but not 90% one way and 10% the other way.
Hmm.
So it's unique. It's unique as language is unique to humans.
How or why are people born left-handed? And are they born left-handed or do they develop this?
Well, they're two good questions. The first one is, you know, why should any, if there's such a negative attitude toward left-handedness, shouldn't it disappear? In other words, if it's genetic, right, people would choose other mates. They would keep by prejudice against them, there'd be later times when they would have children. So
the
law of evolution,
you mean?
Right, right. I mean, you know, other disorders would, you know, unless there's some, but there must be, therefore, if there's a persistent behavior like this, there must be some positive result. There must be some advantage that we just haven't figured out yet. And the other thing is left-handed learned or is it genetic? And there are many people who work in genetics who claim it's genetic, but whenever they announce they found the gene for left-handed, then half the other research population disputes it, and then it goes away. So although logically it could be left-handed, it could be genetic, the evidence is still not in. It's possible that there are several different routes why people become left-handed, some by environmental pressures, some by genetics, and some by early trauma.
You know, it's interesting that I've always heard that left-handed folks are very creative. Is it true that the brains of left-handers are different than right-handers?
Of some left-handers. But the thing about left-handedness is everything you can say about it has to be said with some restraint because the left-handers have been associated with higher talent, creativity, right? But and that's because the assumption has been is that if you use your left hand, then language and other things are in your right hemisphere. If you use your right hand, then the dominant hemisphere is the left hemisphere. But it turns out that if you follow left-handers, only 18% of left-handers are actually right-brained. So it's a small minority. So it could be that that small minority is where the action is. On the other hand, what's really interesting is that 5% of right-handers are right-brained. So given the fact that there are 10 right-handers for every left-hander, in terms of total population, there are more right-handed right-brainers. So if the idea is that being in the right brain as your dominant brain, particularly for language, is more creative, then there still would be more creative right-handers than left-handers in the general population.
Left-handedness has been seen in a negative light throughout history. Can you give us examples of that and how that's manifested?
Sure. I mean, one was that there's a kind of notion that left-handedness was considered profane as opposed to the sacred being in the right side. So left-handers were kept out of all kinds of holy rituals. Even the, you know, priests were told that they should have touched the Eucharist with their right hand, not their left hand. But the other kinds of discrimination were forcing left-handers to be right-handed by tying their hands behind their back.
Whoa.
In fact, the King of England, King King George, who was famous in the movie The King's Speech, was switched when he was 7 or 8 years old, and his hand was tied behind his back, as were many people. My book is full of examples of people who were born even as late as the 1960s who still had that happen. And in some other cultures, a children's hand, if they persist in using their left hand, is put in boiling water among the Zula. But even my mother, who was left-handed, was forced to become right-handed. And wish she was hit with a ruler if she wouldn't switch her hand for writing.
So has this practice pretty much stopped, at least in the U.S.?
Yeah, but it's still common in the rest of the world, and that's about 10% of the world's population. So in the non-Western world, it's still the Chinese claim, for instance, they have no left-handers, which is a hard claim to believe. But that's because they don't report any left-handers because they force all children in schools to be right-handed.
You're listening to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides, and we're talking about the history and science of left-handedness. Our guest is Howard Kushner, author of the new book, On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder, and History. If you have a question or comment, call 614-292-8513 or email allsides@wosu.org. Is there any correlation between left-handedness and learning disabilities or mental illness, as some have claimed?
Well, it turns out that when you look at the populations in general, the discrimination against left-handers has much more negative effect than being left-handed. So, for instance, when left-handers are forced to switch, many developed stuttering. And in the 1930s and 40s at the University of Iowa, the speech pathology people there decided, well, if stuttering was the cause of was caused in most of their patients by hand switching, what would happen if they switched them back? So when they switched them back, in the vast majority of cases, the stuttering disappeared, which is a remarkable finding, really.
Wow.
In terms of other disorders, learning disabilities, left-handedness has been connected in studies. People have been looking at this in terms of autism. I worked originally, got interested in left-handedness when I was working on Tourette syndrome because I thought our patients were more likely to be left-handed, but I think I was wrong. Schizophrenia, all kinds of things have been associated with it, but as much as they've been associated with it, and other people have tried to show that from the evidence isn't that strong. So I'd say the jury is out, but if we want to have the greatest impact on reducing learning disabilities among left-handers, we should stop switching them.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And so
what about other associations with being left-handed? Some say that gay or other attributes.
Right. There are people who have argued, and there was a study as recently as 2000 and several since then, that argued that gays were more likely to be left-handed than non-gays. But when you look at the evidence very carefully, it's not really supported. So what you get is a number of claims. For instance, lesbians are supposed to be more ambidextrous. But when you closely examine the evidence, you find that there's a common thread that of most of these studies, which is the problem is how you define if someone's left-handed or not. And it's not just that they use their left hand for what. Is it eating? Is it throwing? Is it for gesture? Are they left-footed? Are they right-footed? So we'd have this inventory called the Edinburgh Inventory, where you have a list of 10 questions, and you see how left-handed someone is, if they're left-eyed, if they're left-footed, and if they eat with their left hand, if they throw with their left hand, or do they write with their right hand? And in certain societies, they may focus on certain of these tasks than others. So what people have done who want to argue, say, for instance, that gays are more left-handed than straight people, is they have changed the definition of left-handed. So instead of being strongly left-handed, you have anyone who's not 100% strongly right-handed, and then they say all this population together is called non-right-handed, and then they can come to think. So that includes almost everybody. So part of the problem with left-handedness is we don't really have, after all these years, a really agreed-upon definition of what constitutes left-handedness, which is odd, considering.
Really, some people use both. They're ambidextrous. They can use both. And is that a large part of the population?
It may be 2 or 3% of the population, but the question there, again, is definition. One is, is ambidextrous defined as you can do either any task with either hand, or is it that you do different tasks with different hands? And so it's unclear when people use the term ambidextrous what they mean. But there was a big movement at the turn of the century, the turn of the 19th to 20th century, that is, to use both hands. And it was led by the head of the Boy Scouts of Britain and by some other researchers. And therefore, they say you use both sides of your brain. So there have been periodic times when being ambidextrous or something like that has been really encouraged. Hmm. And then after a lot of excitement, it sort of disappears.
We're on the air with Jacqueline from Columbus. Jacqueline, your question or comment?
Oh, hi. Thank you so much for doing this show.
Hi.
My comment is that my mother was born in England, and apparently her mother was left-handed, and she was severely restricted and became, quote-unquote, ambidextrous.
Uh-huh.
And my mother herself had her hand tied behind her back, and she told me also she was punished.
Right.
So she came to America. I was born in America, and I was left-handed, which she encouraged. But I also, being born in the 60s, felt a lot of pressure and a lot of struggle being different by being left-handed.
Right. I think the way you've just described it and traced through the generations is reflects, I think, a lot of the experiences of people who are left-handed, even as late as today. So so I'm not surprised at all. My mother was switched, and I'm left-handed, but I experienced no discrimination by being left-handed, mainly because for boys, being able to bat right-handed, left-handed was an advantage, and throwing left-handed was.
Right.
In fact, if you want to see where the acceptance of left-handedness has been greatest, it's in sports. Because there's some advantage to being left-handed. So although the Chinese claim to have almost no left-handers, they've discovered that left-handed ping-pong players do very well because of surprise. So now they encourage that.
Jacqueline, thank you for your comment. Are there any other advantages to being left-handed other than sports?
There's an argument that the reason there is left-handedness at all is that the element of surprise in battle has been something that left-handers have had to their advantage. So long as the number of left-handers is relatively small, the extent of surprise, right, expecting it to come from one side, but the battle coming, you know, the hitting coming from the other side or throwing a spear from the other side. But once the left-handers get to be more and more within the culture, then the advantage seems to go away.
We'll take another call. Mike from Columbus, you're on the air with your question or comment.
Hi, yes, my comment. I think there's an amazing similarity between handedness and sexual orientation, gay, straight, I mean, here. In the first place, there's this easy idea that, well, it's something that people choose to be when, after all, we can hide, or if you have your right hand tied behind your left hand tied behind your hand, yeah, you can use your right hand and kind of fake it, although you'll always be rather awkward. The association with evil, because, of course, they're in the minority, this sort of continuum that we're all a little bit ambidextrous, but that most of us tend to lean toward one or the other, usually right-handed, but not always. And then finally, just the idea that this both used to be seen as very, very important moral terms. I mean, you were literally possibly burned at the stake as a witch if you were left-handed. That was evidence for witchcraft way back when. And it really makes more sense to just say, get over it. We're all a little bit of both, perhaps, and it really doesn't make that big a deal. Just live with it.
Well, Mike, you know, everything you've just said is I've made the same sorts of arguments in my book, right, that left-handedness, like being gay, is a difference is being discriminated against and the inability to accept difference. So if we look at societies, wherever there's much more openness to difference, right, there are more left-handers. So in a way, left-handedness is a measure of how open a society is.
interesting.
Other kinds of behaviors.
Mike, thank you for your call. You know, it's interesting, as you say, there's so many people who are ambidextrous, and I can tell you that I cannot do a darn thing with my left hand. I mean, really, I'm so right-handed, and I'm sure there's probably a lot of people who are very much, they just use that one hand.
I think that's probably true. But what's interesting is when people are forced through some accident or other way, other reason to use their non-dominant hand, many of them learn to do it in any case. About a year ago, a reporter from the New York Times called me and said that he was an avid tennis player but couldn't play anymore because his right shoulder was so injured. He said, so could he learn to be left-handed as a tennis player? And I thought that'd be pretty hard because I've tried it myself to be other hand, to use my right hand to play tennis. And yet a year later, he wrote a story in the New York Times about how he was successful.
Wow.
So I guess he cared so much about tennis that it overcame whatever physical limitations there were.
And do you feel, being left-handed, that you have any limitations yourself?
Not particularly. I've always found it to be an advantage, but that was sort of unique. And maybe because I saw the disadvantage my mother suffered from having to sew with her right hand by doing other things. And as a result, she seemed to have more problems with coordination. And so, again, growing up when I did in the 1950s and 60s, being left-handed as a boy was not necessarily seen as a negative thing.
Mm-hmm. So are you going to be celebrating Left-Hander Day Sunday?
I certainly will.
And we encourage all left-handers to celebrate, right?
Right.
Thank you. We have been talking to Howard Kushner, author of the book, On the Other Hand, Left Hand, Right Brain, Mental Disorder in History. Thank you for joining us, Howard.
Thank you, Gail, for having me.
Wellness Wednesday continues with new efforts to control cornea disease. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to Wellness Wednesday on All Sides with Ann Fisher. I'm Gail Hogan, sitting in for Ann today. Nearly 200,000 Americans have an eye problem called keratoconus, or KC. That's when the cornea, the clear windshield in front of the eye, gets progressively distorted until a transplant is the only way to prevent possible blindness. At 15, Maxton Tomsic learned he was developing the eye condition during a routine eye doctor's visit. Maxton is now 16. He's a student from Pickerington. He joins us in the studio. Hi, Max. Thanks
hey,
for being here. Also joining us is Max's doctor, Dr. Ken Beckman, who is involved in a new treatment for keratoconus that does not involve a major transplant. Dr. Beckman is the director of corneal surgery at Comprehensive Eye Care of Central Ohio and a clinical assistant professor of ophthalmology at Ohio State University. He also joins us in the studio. Welcome to you, Dr. Beckman.
Thanks for having me.
Can we first have a base definition, Dr. Beckman, of what keratoconus is?
Sure.
And I have to tell you, I'd never heard of this before.
Well, it's surprisingly more common than you think. It's a corneal condition. The cornea, again, is the window to the front of the eye. And over the years, it gradually can become thin and distorted. And it's just like looking through a funhouse mirror, how it'll distort images. And it usually starts in the teens and can progress through your 20s and 30s. And it can get to the point where eventually you can't wear glasses or contacts, and the only treatment would be corneal transplant surgery.
And why do we see it beginning to show up in the teen years?
Well, we don't know why, but that's just tends to be when it is. And it tends to slow down as you get older. So people in their 50s or 60s, if they've maintained good vision to that point, there's a good likelihood that they won't need a problem. It's just the ones that we catch early can progress so rapidly if you don't do anything about it, that someone like Max, who we find at 15, by the time he was 25, he probably would have ended up needing a transplant if we weren't able to treat him.
Do we know what causes it? Is this something you're born with and then shows up in these years?
Well, we think there's a genetic component to it, and it is associated a lot with people who have bad allergy problems and that may tend to rub their eyes a lot. So we think that eye rubbing may cause or increase the distortion. I don't know how strong that connection is, but we usually tell our patients not to rub their eyes.
Max, did you have distorted vision? Is that how you found that you had the problem?
Well, yeah, from a very young age, I didn't really like to wear glasses because I always felt like there were scratches or lines on it. But later I figured out that was from the character Conus, and that was related to it.
And I'm sure as a child, you don't have anything to compare it to, so what do you know, right? That's kind of the norm.
It was I just figured, yeah, that's probably what's just something going on in my eye, nothing much.
How did you figure out it was different? It was KC.
Well, we figured out we were going to a routine checkup, and our doctor told us that they thought it was keratoconus, but they really didn't know for sure. So they told us to go up to Ohio Health and take a look at it, and then we later did figure out that it was keratoconus.
And did you have any other issues? Did you have asthma or anything like that that would lead you to have itchy eyes or rubbing of your eyes?
No.
No? And what about people that do then, Dr. Beckman, have KC and asthma and everything? I would think that would exacerbate whatever condition is there.
Well, you know, there's so many diseases that work together. And so these chronic allergy patients have other allergy problems, but they tend to, from an eye standpoint, they get these red, itchy eyes, they're watery, and they're rubbing them all the time. And again, I don't know how strongly the connection is from the true rubbing, but we definitely see effects of rubbing if you were to try it in your office. So, you know, if you were to take a picture of someone's eye and rub on it and then do the mapping right after, you can tell it's going to distort the eye. So someone who's got an inherently weak eye to begin with, and then you're rubbing it constantly, will just add to it.
Well, Max, what was your reaction when you heard that this is what you had? Scared?
I think I was taken back a little, because when you hear that there's no possible treatment at the time of getting that news, I was just like, oh, I guess I'll wait 10 years and then I'll get a transplant, which it was scary, but I really didn't have much time to think. I kind of just sat there and I was like, I guess everything will be all right.
But now there's other alternatives, right, Dr. Beckman?
Right.
Tell me about it.
Absolutely. Okay. The treatment that we're doing now is called collagen cross-linking. This has been available overseas for a number of years, but just got approved in the U.S. about a year ago. We were lucky enough to be participating in two of the FDA trials, so we've been doing it for about 4 or 5 years. What this treatment is, it's not really surgical. We treat the eye with a chemical called riboflavin, which is a naturally occurring vitamin. It's in all of our diets, so it's not anything that's toxic or scary. And we give the patient eye drops for a period of about 30 minutes. Then we shine ultraviolet light onto the cornea while we're continuing the eye drops. The ultraviolet light leads to a reaction with the riboflavin in the cornea to strengthen the tissue to form these bonds, or what we call crosslinks. So it's kind of like galvanizing rubber. It's making the tissue become stiff so that it'll stop progressing and thinning and bulging. So the primary goal is to lock it in its tracks. If you can catch somebody right off the bat when they still have good vision and treat them, that's when it works best. But the secondary goal is that it may start to actually flatten and regain a more spherical shape so that you can actually improve vision, not just stabilize it.
So you can reverse in some cases,
yes.
KC.
Right.
Are you seeing that a lot? I mean, is there a percentage?
We do see quite a bit of it, in fact. In the FDA trials that Avedro did to get approval, they found in following the patients, I believe it was about a year or two, that the ones that were untreated or were treated with a placebo, they continued to progress and got worse by about a diopter and a half, which is a unit of measurement. The ones who were treated actually flattened by that same amount. So the difference in 1 year's time between the untreated group and the treated group was pretty dramatic. They weren't just staying where they were actually flattening out. And they gain a certain quality of vision. It may get rid of some of the ghosting images that they get, like he was talking about the lines in his vision.
Right.
It just gives you a much smoother contour. And even Max had a pretty good improvement in his worse eye. He improved to the point where he was actually able to pass his driver's test without glasses.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to say, you're sitting there not wearing glasses. I wondered if you wore contacts.
Oh, I do wear contacts, definitely. When I did take my temps test, it was very difficult to get it because, like I said, my eyesight was just not there yet to really compete with it. But after that, when I took my driver's test, it was almost perfect.
Wow. Now, is this an FDA trial, doctor, or is it fully approved by the FDA?
This is now fully approved.
Does it matter, you know, age, sex, anything as far as who can be compatible with this?
Well, in general, the the approval goes to, I believe, down to 14 years of age, but you can theoretically treat people younger. It tends to show up in the teens. And so the ones who respond are people like Max, you know, a 16-year-old who are catching very early. I've treated patients in their 50s or 60s. They may not be progressing anymore. Some of them are, but just the treatment can give them enough improvement that may improve even just a few lines on the chart, but it may be enough to keep them from having to get a corneal transplant.
Is this is KC something that is on the radar of most ophthalmologists, that they look for this in routine, you know, eye exams in kids?
It is on the radar. Not everyone necessarily tests for it. So what we need to do is instruct the gatekeepers, the optometrists and the general ophthalmologists, that if they see somebody who has a lot of astigmatism, which is an abnormal shape in the cornea, or that their vision is not correcting to where they would expect it to, and they don't find anything else, that they should do the special testing. The hardest part is getting the mindset to change. It used to be we just lived with this. If I made this diagnosis on Max 10 years ago, I would have just watched him every year and said, come back, there's nothing we're going to do until you need the transplant. Now, the minute you make the diagnosis, you need to get them referred to a specialist who can do something about it, because you may want to treat them while they're still 20/20.
And really, they can sometimes keep them at that.
Yes.
Pretty amazing. We are talking with Dr. Beckman, the director of corneal surgery at Comprehensive Eye Care of Central Ohio and a clinical assistant professor of ophthalmology at Ohio State University, and one of his patients, Max Tomczyk, who has KC or keratoconus, and that's what we're discussing. If you have any questions or comments, call us at 614-292-8513 or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Is there a corneal transplant in Max's future, or if we keep down, or you keep down, this road of effective therapy, will it be enough?
Well, we hope that one treatment will work. And now the treatment, again, has only been approved in the U.S. for a year, and we've been studying it for, you know, 15 years. But so far, it looks like if we can stabilize things, he may go his whole life and never have a problem. If he were to start to progress in several years and start to get worse, we can actually treat it again. There is a very, very small percentage of patients who will break through and end up needing a transplant despite the treatment. But having done this treatment won't get in the way of their ability to get the transplant later. So it's not like they're losing out on the opportunity for that treatment by doing this.
Max, how has your life changed, or because your sight has changed?
Oh, it's been pretty dramatic. I didn't think that it would change it that much.
Really?
But the day after I got my surgery, I was going into the school play, and obviously I was pretty nervous about it, the big lights. I didn't know if that would interfere with my vision or anything. And but I went into it. It was flying colors. It was one of the best shows I've done. Well, the first shows I've done, but it was an amazing, life-changing experience. And I think that without the surgery, I don't know what would have happened.
So what is your sight now? What are they – I don't know, 20/20, or is that what do they call it?
Well, I don't remember his charts, but I know he was very close to 20/20. In his good eye, the one that we did second, started at a very good place, very close to 20/20, and he's maintained that. The worse eye started somewhere in the 20/50 or 60 range, which is not as good, and it had corrected to very close to 20/20 after – it's been about, what, 6 months now, right?
Yes, around 6 months.
How many treatments – how many years will you have to keep doing this?
It's a one-time treatment.
Really?
Yeah.
You just keep watching him to make sure that nothing goes
backward.
That's
what we do. Just keep monitoring.
If it would start to go backward, do you do another treatment like this?
Yeah, that's what we were saying. If it starts to show signs of progression, he certainly can have it. Fortunately, I've not had to treat anyone a second time.
Really?
But of course, we've only been doing it, other than in the FDA trials, we've only been doing it for a year in the U.S. So in the FDA trials, I didn't have anyone that regressed, and I haven't seen anybody so far in this that's doing worse. So hopefully they'll just keep moving on.
How did this even come about, that this, you know, riboflavin?
Riboflavin.
Riboflavin became something that you figured is going to work on the eye.
Well, the brilliance of some ophthalmologists in Europe that came up with this idea, I don't know how they came up with this, but it was in the late 90s when it was first discovered. And it's been gradually investigated over the years, and it's been approved in Europe for a number of years. We had patients in the States that would have to go to Canada or to Europe or other places to get it done. Until, like I said, until about a year ago. When we started the treatment, the study was probably 2012 or 2013, the one that we were on. We had no other option. If somebody had this, they either had to go overseas or eventually they could enroll in our study. And so we were able to offer treatment to a number of patients. And now anybody can have it.
What is the disadvantage of a corneal transplant? Obviously, it's surgery. And so that right there is you know, cause for possible complications, I suppose.
Right. It's a big surgery.
Is it?
So the success rate is very high, but you're getting donor tissue from another patient. So for the rest of your life, you're going to be monitored. You could theoretically reject the cornea. You could need another cornea. If we treat somebody who's 25, there's a very high likelihood that when they're 60, they may need another one. It may not last forever. It's a constant follow-up using drops for many years, maybe even the rest of your life.
Because it's, again, you should talk anti-rejection drugs like any other transplant.
Right. A steroid eye drop is commonly used for many years. The risk of trauma, just because you now have a big incision in the eye, and if somebody gets hit in the eye after having a transplant, they're very vulnerable. And when you think that you're dealing with the young population, teenagers, they're the ones that are most active and most at risk. It's hard to tell a 16-year-old, don't go play football with all your friends. And if you have a transplant, you're very vulnerable.
So a transplant isn't in your future, apparently, Max. I bet that makes you feel pretty good.
It's pretty amazing to hear.
I'm sure.
Knowing that I won't have to wear big goggles every time I go out and do something.
Is that part of it, too?
Well, we hope he doesn't get there.
Now, do you do the transplant as well? You do.
I do, yes.
And so how many, now that this is available, what's the percentage of folks that need transplants compared to being able to use this new treatment?
Well, it should go down dramatically.
Mm-hmm.
At this point, the most of the patients that we're doing are not at the transplant level yet. We're trying to prevent them from getting there. So what I explain commonly to patients is 50 years ago, they came out with a polio vaccine. Everyone got their vaccine. No one felt any different. But 50 years later, we aren't treating people for polio. So I think we're going to have a whole generation of kids that are 18 years old that get treated with this. 30 years from now, we'll look back and none of these people are getting transplants where they otherwise would have.
In the all-encompassing good eye health, what should people be doing?
Related to this or anything?
Related to anything. Well, I mean, I know sports, goggles, you talked about wearing people are, you know, conscious of their head. What about consciousness of their eyes?
Take care of your eyes. That means wearing eye protection if you're doing anything, whether it's, you know, drilling, doing, you know, work around the house.
Yard work,
things. Just be careful. Eating right. Nutrition is important for everything, including the eyes. You know, those are the main things. Dry eyes are probably the most common thing that I see, and we're now seeing it even in younger people. We used to think it was women as they go through hormone changes in life, but now we're seeing college students because they're on their screens 24/7 and they're abusing their contacts and they're staying up late studying and they're drinking caffeine and they're getting dehydrated and they're eating McDonald's every day, so they have bad nutrition.
And that all relates to the eye.
It all relates to the eye.
Now, what about these other vitamins I've also heard that I've seen taking, you know, supplements? Does any of that stuff work?
Yes, it does. Now, that's unrelated to his condition.
Right.
But there are vitamins that we use for a condition called macular degeneration, which is a condition in the retina, the back of the eye, that people get as they get older. And there are vitamins available that we use specifically for that. We commonly use supplements like omega-3 supplements, fish oil, which can work really well for dry eyes. So a lot of patients who I'm treating for dry eye may have them on omega-3 fish oil, which can be really helpful. So those are two of the most common ones.
It's interesting that something like fish oil can can help your eyes.
Right.
Well, this is really stunning, and I'm sure stunning news for you, Mac. Mm-hmm. So you're 15, you're Pickerington. What are your plans for the future?
Well, right now I'm in chorale, singing, dancing. I'm having a lot of fun with that. I plan to try out for the play this year, and I'm also making a short film with some of my friends.
Oh, well, you know, all my kids were in the arts, so I wish you the best of luck in that. And mm-hmm. Dr. Beckham, it's been a pleasure talking with you. And do you see now more and more ophthalmologists even locally doing this? Is this going to be something that becomes commonplace?
Well, eventually it will. Right now, I believe I'm the only one who's doing it.
You are just the only one.
In Columbus, although there will be some, I would imagine, eventually.
Does it take special training and all that stuff?
Yeah, and the equipment is very expensive to get, and and not everybody is seeing the volume of patients to justify doing it, to seeing the volume of corneal patients. But I know there's somebody in Cleveland that does it, and there's going to be more popping up. But it'll probably be more to specific centers rather than everybody doing this in their office.
Is it expensive? Health insurance cover it, all that stuff?
Well, right now, very few insurance companies cover it. And it can be expensive. Over time, we're hoping that we'll get more approval. The chemical itself, the riboflavin, is very expensive. And then plus buying the equipment and then the procedure, which takes an hour and a half to do. So there's a lot of time with the patients, a lot of time with your staff. So it can be a costly procedure.
Well, we're glad you're doing it. Dr. Beckham, thank you so much for being here. And Max, it's been a pleasure.
Mm-hmm.
Max, it's Tomsic, good luck in your play.
Oh, yeah.
Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
That's all the time we have. Thanks to Dr. Ken Beckman, and he is a corneal surgeon at Comprehensive Eye Care of Central Ohio and a clinical assistant professor of ophthalmology at OSU. Thanks for listening today. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.